The Battle of Britain. Winston Churchill reads from his war memoirs, chapter 16.
We must take September the 15th as the culminating date of the air battle. On this day, the Luftwaffe, after two heavy attacks on the 14th, made its greatest concentrated effort in a resumed daylight attack on London. It was one of the decisive battles of the war, and like the Battle of Waterloo, it was on a Sunday. I was at Chequers. I had already on several occasions visited the headquarters of No. 11 Fighter Group in order to witness the conduct of an air battle, where not much had happened. However, the weather on this day seemed suitable to the enemy, and accordingly I drove over to Uxbridge and arrived at the group headquarters. No. 11 Group comprised no fewer than 25 squadrons, covering the whole of Essex, Kent, Sussex, and Hampshire, and all the approaches across them to London. Our Vice Marshal Park had for 6 months commanded this group, on which our fate largely depended. From the beginning of Dunkirk, all the daylight actions in the south of England had already been conducted by him, and all its arrangements and apparatus had been brought to the highest perfection. My wife and I were taken down to the bomb-proof operations room 50 feet below ground. All the ascendancy of the Hurricanes and Spitfires would have been fruitless but for this system of underground control centers and telephone cables which had been devised and built before the war by the Air Ministry under Dowding's advice and impulse. Lasting credit is due to all concerned. In the south of England there were at this time No. 11 Group headquarters and 6 subordinate fighter station centers. All these were, as has been described, under heavy stress. The supreme command was exercised from the fighter headquarters at Stanmore, but the actual handling of the direction of the squadrons was widely left to No. 11 Group, which controlled the units through its fighter stations located in each county. The group operations room was like a small theater, about 60 feet across and with 2 stories. We took our seats in the dress circle. Below us was the large-scale map table, around which perhaps 20 highly trained young men and women with their telephone assistants were assembled. Opposite to us, covering the entire wall, where the theater curtain would be, was a gigantic blackboard divided into 6 columns with electric bulbs for the 6 fighter stations, each of their squadrons having a subcolumn of its own, and also divided by lateral lines. Thus, the lowest row of bulbs showed, as they were lighted, the squadrons which were standing by at 2 minutes' notice. The next row, those at readiness, 5 minutes. Then, at available, 20 minutes. Then, those which had taken off. The next row, those which had reported having seen the enemy. The next, with red lights, those which were in action. And the top row, those which were returning home. On the left-hand side, in a kind of glass stage box, were the 4 or 5 officers whose duty it was to weigh and measure the information received from our observer corps, which at this time numbered upwards of 50,000 men, women, and youths. Radar was still in its infancy, but it gave warning of raids approaching our coast, and the observers with field glasses and portable telephones were our main source of information about radars flying over land. Thousands of messages were therefore received during an action. Several roomfuls of experienced people in other parts of the underground headquarters shifted them with great rapidity and transmitted the results from minute to minute directly to the plotters seated round the table on the floor and to the officer supervising from the glass stage box. On the right was another glass stage box containing army officers who reported the action of our anti-aircraft batteries, of which at this time in the command there were 200. At night it was of vital importance to stop these batteries firing over certain areas in which our fighters would be closing with the enemy. I was not unacquainted with the general outlines of this system, having had it explained to me a year before the war by Dowding when I visited him at Stanmore. It had been shaped and refined in constant action, and all was now fused together into a most elaborate instrument of war, the like of which existed nowhere in the world. "I don't know," said Park as we went down, whether anything will happen today. At present, all is quiet. However, after a quarter of an hour, the raid plotters began to move about. An attack of 40 plus was reported to be coming from the German stations in the Dieppe area. The bulbs along the bottom of the wall display panel began to glow as various squadrons came to stand by. Then in quick succession, 20 plus, 40 plus signals were received, and in another 10 minutes it was evident that a serious battle impended. On both sides the air began to fill. One after another signals came in, 40 plus, 60 plus, there was even an 80 plus. Around the floor table below us, the movement of all the waves of attack was marked by pushing discs forward from minute to minute along different lines of approach, while on the blackboard facing us, the rising lights showed our fighter squadrons getting into the air, till there were only four or five left at readiness. These air battles, on which so much depended, lasted little more than an hour from the first encounter. The enemy had ample strength to send out new waves of attack, and our squadrons, having gone all out to gain the upper air, would have to refuel after 70 or 80 minutes, or land to rearm after a 5 minute engagement. If at this moment of refueling or rearming, the enemy were able to arrive with fresh, unchallenged squadrons, some of our fighters could be destroyed on the ground. It was therefore one of our principal objects to direct our squadrons so as not to have too many on the ground refueling or rearming simultaneously during daylight. Presently the red bulb showed that the majority of our squadrons were engaged. A subdued hum arose from the floor, where the busy plotters pushed their discs to and fro in accordance with the swiftly changing situation. The air marshal himself walked up and down behind, watching with vigilant eye every move in the game, supervising his junior executive hand, and only occasionally intervening with some decisive order, usually to reinforce a threatened area. In a little while, all our squadrons were fighting, and some had already begun to return to fuel. All were in the air. The lower line of bulbs was out. There was not one squadron left in reserve. At this moment, Park spoke to Dowding at Stanmore, asking for three squadrons from number 12 group to be put at his disposal in case of another major attack while his squadrons were rearming and refueling. This was done. They were specially needed to cover London and our fighter aerodromes because number 11 group had already shot their boat. The young officer, to whom this seemed a matter of routine, continued to give his orders in accordance with the general directions of his group commander in a calm, low monotone. And the three reinforcing squadrons were soon absorbed. I became conscious of the anxiety of the commander, who now stood still behind his subordinate's chair. Hitherto I had watched in silence. I now asked, "What other reserves have we?" "There are none," said Air Vice Marshal Park. In an account which he wrote about it afterwards, he said that at this I looked grave. Well, I might. What losses should we not suffer if our refueling planes were caught on the ground by further raids of 40 plus or 50 plus. The odds were great, our margins small, the stakes infinite. Another 5 minutes passed, and most of our squadrons had now descended to refuel. In many cases, our resources could not give them overhead protection. Then it appeared that the enemy were going home. The shifting of the discs on the table below showed a continuous eastward movement of the German bombers and fighters. No new attack appeared. In another 10 minutes, the action was ended. We climbed again the stairways which led to the surface, and almost as we emerged, the all-clear sounded. "We are very glad, sir, you have seen this," said Park. "Of course, during the last 20 minutes, we were so choked with information we couldn't handle it. This shows you the limitation of our present resources. They have been strained far beyond their limits today." I asked whether any results had come to hand, and remarked that the attack appeared to have been repelled satisfactorily. Park replied that he was not satisfied that we had intercepted as many raiders as he had hoped we should. It was evident that the enemy had everywhere pierced our defenses. Many scores of German bombers with their fighter escort had been reported over London. About a dozen had been brought down while I was below. But no picture of the results of the battle, or of the damage, or losses could be obtained. It was 4:30 p.m. before I got back to Chequers. and I immediately went to bed for my afternoon sleep. I must have been tired by the drama of Number 11 Group, for I did not wait till 8. When I rang, John Martin, my principal private secretary, came in with the evening budget of news from all over the world. It was repellent. This had gone wrong here. That had been delayed there. An unsatisfactory answer had been received from so-and-so. There had been bad sinkings in the Atlantic. However, said Martin, as he finished this account, all is redeemed by the air. We have shot down 183 for a loss of under 40. Although post-war information has shown that the enemy's losses on this day were only 56, September 15 was the crux of the Battle of Britain. That same night, our bomber command attacked in strength the shipping in the ports from Boulogne to Antwerp. At Antwerp, particularly heavy losses were inflicted. On September 17, as we now know, the Führer decided to postpone Ceylon indefinitely. It was not until October the 12th that the invasion was formally called off till the following spring. In July 1941, it was postponed again by Hitler till the spring of 1942, by which time the Russian campaign will be completed. So he said, this was a vain but an important imagining. On February the 13th, 1942, Admiral Raeder had his final interview on Ceylon and got Hitler to agree to a complete stand down. Thus perished Operation Ceylon, and September 15 may stand as the date of its demise.